Gibbs, founder of Incandescent Public Relations, publisher of Being Incandescent Business Magazine, and your host for the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. Who says crime doesn't pay? Not Louis Ferrante, an associate of the Gambino family who by age 21 had netted millions for his employers. He says his natural talent for management led mafia bosses to rely on him. And that's a man who paid a big price for the crimes he committed, more than 8 years in prison. We are here today talking to Lou. Thank you so much for being on the Incandescent Radio Network.
Hey, thanks for having me, Hope.
So let's talk a little bit about your history. So while in prison, you realized there was more to life than you knew, and you decided to go straight. You also realized that the mob's most valuable business lessons would allow you to survive and thrive in the real world. Clearly, you were right, because in the years since, you've written two books, Unlocked, a memoir of your criminal life and your time in prison, and the bestseller that we're talking about today, Mob Rules, What the Mafia Can Teach the Legitimate Businessman, which was published in 2011. That book has been translated into 15 languages and read by millions around the world. Your work has also landed you a TV show called Inside the Gangster's Code, which is currently airing in 217 countries on Discovery Network International. So let's talk about this turnaround. What made you change your ways, and what lessons did you learn that you can share with business leaders?
A lot of things went into the gradual process inside my head that created change. One of the first things was when I was locked up with the mob, I realized with other mobsters that I lived with on the street, now we're in jail, and I'm starting to learn that a lot of the guys who were locked up alongside me committed crimes where people may have been killed from the family, and you were never supposed to kill anybody unless it was a question of principle. You don't kill for money. That's something the mafia never did in the old days. They never killed over money. They killed over principle. There was something that someone had to be taken care of. And I understood that was part of the code. When I was in prison with these guys, I learned that a lot of people that I knew had killed other people for money. And that bothered me tremendously, that people had died for greed. I said, I can't believe that I belong to an organization that would kill for greed. That was despicable to me. So that was starting, you know, already to twist my brain in a different direction, saying I was around a bunch of snakes. That's not the people, the old timers in that life didn't raise me that way. That wasn't right. Then just basically, you know, thinking over my life and realizing that sticking a gun at somebody's head and taking his money or beating somebody up with a baseball bat just wasn't the right way to do things. Wasn't the way my mother raised me. It's just the way the streets kind of like, you know, nurtured me, but not the way my mother did. So I started to think things out and realized it was wrong and started to direct my mind in a different direction. And that led to books, and books led to knowledge, and knowledge led to understanding, etc. And here I am today with you now.
Just simply amazing. So let's go back to the beginning. In Mob Rules, you share that you began stealing at age 12, hijacked your first truck in your late teens, and were heading your own crew in the Gambino family in your early 20s. So you talk about lovingly about your mom. What led you to a life of crime, especially at such an early age?
Yeah, my mother and father were good people, but you know, when I left the house, I did what I wanted. So I always hung out with the mischievous kids, and we would steal cars, and we would do, you know, just joyride when we were younger. And just take a car for the night, do some donuts in the parking lot, pick up a girl from the neighborhood, cruise around, try to impress her. And, you know, that's early teens, 13, 14, 15 years old. Before I even had a license, we would be doing that, me and my friends. Then as we got a little older, we realized that we could steal cars, and parts were a commodity. You could sell parts to the auto body collision shops in Queens. And few people realized that. Probably 90%, if not more, back then, of the auto body collision shops were crooked. They would take parts off you under the table. You know, they would pay you under the table rather for stolen parts, and they would be able then to mark up the job. So if your car was like hitting an accident, you took it to an auto body collision shop, the insurance company would appraise it at, let's say, $10,000 worth of damage. Maybe $5,000 went towards parts, $5,000 for labor. If they were able to buy the parts off me and my friends for $1,000 or $2,000, they put an extra $3,000 or $4,000 in their pocket. So that's kind of how it worked. And we started selling the parts. And then that led to, I was in an auto body shop one day, and I realized that these giant toolboxes that the workers were using cost $7,000-$8,000 a piece. And the guy told me the truck comes once a week to deliver parts for the toolboxes, you know, the tools rather inside the boxes. And he has also toolboxes in there. And I said, what's the truck worth to you? And he goes, well, it's probably worth like $100,000. And I think he offered me 20 cents on the dollar. I negotiated to 30 and I hijacked the truck. And then I started to, I entered a new league at that point. I was hijacking. And then I put together a hijacking crew the same way I put together a crew of car thieves. Now I put together a crew of hijackers. And we were taking trucks all over New York left and right. And once you start doing that, obviously, and, you know, the Gambino crime family is like the government within a government. So they, you know, they want to, just like the IRS is going to find out if you open up a business and you're making money, the Gambino family is going to find out if you're on the streets and you're making money. So they knew that I was taking down big scores, and they came looking for me. And by the time they came looking for me, I was happy that they did, because you want to be, I mean, that's the next level of street activity, to be part of the mob. When you're an Italian American, that's the ultimate. You know, that's like if you're like a computer hack fooling around with stuff in your dining room, and, you know, Bill Gates pays you a visit and he's knocking on your window and saying, hey, you know, why don't you come with us at Microsoft? We could make you a star. That's sort of the way I thought when the Gambinos came looking for me.
Wow, amazing. So how were you finally caught and put into prison?
I was caught I didn't realize this, because it wasn't in my makeup to snitch on somebody. It just wasn't something that I could do. So in all of my naivety at the time, I just figured that no one would, you know, my friends would never snitch on me. And the guys in the mob that I looked up to, the older guys, for example, John Gotti was the Don back then of the family, and the underboss was Sammy the Bull Gravano, and he was a guy I looked up to, and he snitched. When he snitched, I couldn't believe it. I just didn't believe it. You know, those guys could never snitch. So I, you know, again, I was very, at the time, young and didn't realize that because I couldn't do something, someone else couldn't. And that's how I was put in jail eventually. You know, guys got in trouble and for different things, whether it was murder or hijacking, and they would get in trouble and then make a deal with the feds and rat on the rest of us. And I got caught in one of those things. My snitch was a guy who went into the witness protection program. He said he feared me at the time. I was probably a guy who should be feared at that time. He went into the witness protection program and he agreed to testify against me and my crew. And then we all got locked up. And me and all of my crew who got locked up together, we all refused to snitch on other people, because that's usually what they do, is it's like a revolving door, rather. You snitch on the next group of guys and then you could get your freedom quicker. And it's what a lot of people choose to do. But me and my crew stood up, the guys that got arrested with me, after the initial rat went bad. The rest of us did stand up, and we all did time. We all did hard time, too. I was sent to the penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, the maximum security penitentiary, my very first day in population. Very first day, there was a double homicide. The Aryan Brotherhood hacked to death and gutted two black Muslims. So that was my entrance into the penitentiary, day one, blood all over the Tia blocks, guys getting hacked up with machetes. So you pay the price when you don't snitch. You kind of, you know, you realize when these guys do go sour and get out of jail, you realize why they do. When you're sitting behind the wall of the penitentiary and you're looking at people getting chopped up with machetes, homemade prison machetes.
Just unbelievable. This is a life that most people don't know about, clearly, especially in the small business community. But tell us, so you never informed on your friends or associates. So how did you regain your freedom?
So in time, as I'm in prison, I'm sitting in there, and in the beginning, all of us are locked up, meaning all the guys from the different five, there's five families in New York. There's the Lucchese family, the Colombo family, the Bonanno, the Genovese, and the Gambino family. So I knew people from all those different families that I hobnobbed with every day of my life, my social life and my business life. They were the only people I really, you know, knew. Other, you know, in that world, it's a very insular world. The guys you deal with are the guys you live and breathe with. So we were all getting locked up at breakneck speed. And at one point or another, we were all in a Brooklyn holdover prison, a federal prison in Brooklyn. And all of us, there's a holdover down there by the water. And all of us are in there. And I just looked around. There were so many of us in there, so many of my friends, that they could have really just built a fence around the neighborhood. And basically, that's how many of us were in there. So we're playing cards and we're enjoying ourselves. still living the mafia life. We have people coming up on visits who were collecting money for us. I still had hijacked loads hidden that I was selling. I still had a loan shark book on the street. So I was collecting money for the money that I lent out. Everything continues, and you're still a mobster. Because you got locked up, you don't stop being a mobster. You're just a mobster who's serving his time. But at one point or another, as I said, I was going through these different thoughts, you know, thoughts rather, were floating through my head about the code and stuff and how it wasn't really what it was cracked up to be, what I was taught it was, what the old timers believed in. The newer generation was kind of like dismissing the code whenever it was convenient, and I didn't believe in that. I believed in the way the old timers thought. So I started thinking differently. Then I went to the hole and for somebody else. I was getting into a lot of fights. I would go to the hole now and then because there's strong ethnic lines in prison, strong racially and ethnic lines where, you know, there's Spanish, there's Chinese, there's Italian, there's black, there's different types of Spanish. The Dominicans might be fighting with the Puerto Ricans, etc. And I wasn't raised like that. And Italians really, believe it or not, Italians aren't prejudiced. Italians will do business with absolutely anyone and sit down and play a card game with anyone. So I was never prejudiced. But in jail, you're forced in the American prison system to choose the side that your physical makeup, you know, puts you in. So if you're Italian American, that's your, you know, you go with the Italian American. So I was getting into fights because then different groups always fight with each other over extra pieces of cake from the kitchen, the phones, maybe whatever it might be. And I would go to the hole, but on this one occasion, I went to the hole for a fight that I did not, I mean, for an incident rather that I did not do. Somebody threw an apple at the guard, and it cracked open when it hit his head. It cracked apart when it hit his head and gave him a shiner. And he was an older guy, and it was dark, and they thought it came from me. It was in the dormitory at the time. And it came, so they locked me up, put me in the hole, and I had words. They didn't want to give me my clothes. They were making me suffer because they thought I assaulted a guard. They didn't want to give me clothes. They didn't want to give me a mattress. And I had words with the lieutenant, the captain of the guards, rather. And I went to grab his tie through the food slot, and I pulled it off his neck. It was a clip-on. I didn't know that. So I threw the clip-on back at him, you know, through the food slot. And I said, you know, it's a clip-on, you know, you dirty bastard. And he looked at me, and he said, you think we'd wear real ties with you animals in here? And that was a big wake-up call. He goes, look at you. You're an animal. He says, you're an animal in a zoo. You're not allowed out of this cell unless you're in chains. And that's true. When you're in the hole, you can't leave there unless you're chained up. You have to push your hands back up to the door, push your hands through the food slot, get handcuffed and chained, and then walk away from the door to be allowed out of the cell. So you really feel like an animal. So I just started to think, and I said, my mother really, you know, did raise me right. She wasn't a bad person. And what did I do wrong? You know, at that point in my life, I had committed so much violence and, you know, it's just criminal activity was my career. So I started to rethink things. When I got out of the hole, I said to myself, you know, I cannot go on like this. I called up a friend of mine who was the caretaker of John Gotti's social club. His name was Fat George, and he had tattoos all over his body, and some of the tattoos were biblical verses. So I figured maybe he read a book. You know, he might have at least read the Bible. And I called him up and I said, can you send me books? And he says, you know, sure, no problem. What do you want? Big boobs, you know, big behinds? What do you like? And I said, no, I'm not looking for those kind of books. I want to read a book. And he said, what do you want to read? And at that point, I never read a book before in my life. And I was literate. I went to school when I was a kid. I just, you know, I cheated my way through school, never read a book, never, you know, nothing. I never studied. I just, everything was like, how can I get over? So it was always just cheating to get by. So I had people do my homework, people do my projects. Don't forget, too, in school, in my high school years, I got a stolen car ring. So I got pockets full of money compared to the other kids. So I could pay people to do anything. I always got by. So now I started to read, and I fell in love with books. And that started to really, really open up a new world to me. You know, I thought Chinese people came from Flushing. You know, New York. I didn't know there's China. There's a huge place called China, and it's kind of like, in this place called Asia, and off the coast of China is Hong Kong and Singapore and Malaysia, and Southeast Asia is here, and you start to learn all these different things. And the British Empire started out in this little tiny island called Great Britain, where the UK is here, where most of the people came from London, and it just started to open up my mind to a whole other world. And now when I visit, or when I travel all over the world, and I've been to dozens of countries now, whenever I land in a country, I know the whole history of that country before I even get there. And people who pick me up from the airport are sometimes baffled with my knowledge of their history and their country. They say, how would you know, unless you have this ancestry in your blood, how would you know all this? And I said, I read and read and read. And that's what I did for the next 8.5 years. I just kept reading.
Unbelievably cool. So you decided to go straight. Tell us a little bit about that evolution.
I knew I lived in a really, really, every day of your life in the mob is how to make money. And, everybody is constantly thinking about how to make money. That's what the mafia is. It's an organization that revolves around money. And it's called a family. So it's like being in a family of money makers. So at some point or another, the only thing that I realized that we did wrong was we had no real moral code. We just would anything to make a buck. It did, the code was actually the code that I spoke about that the old timers had was devolving. It was getting worse and worse. But, within our own rules, we had our own rules and code system. But within that, you could do whatever you want to make money. In other words, if you want to rob a bank, that's within our code. That's fine. You could rob a bank. You just shouldn't shoot people on the street when you're robbing the bank. Don't do that, because innocent people should never be hurt by what we do. So as long as you know what you're doing, you could go rob the bank. So just to give you an idea, it's a code, but it's a twisted code. If somebody owed me money, I can't go to the guy's house to collect my money because he has a wife and kids maybe, or his mother or whoever might be home. How dare I offend his family and the sacredness of his home? So now, why it's a twisted code is because if I catch him down the block at the pub, I could get him coming out of the pub and I could run him over with my car, back over him 4 times and put him in a body cast, and his family still has to visit him. But as long as I don't do it in front of the family, it's within our code. So to give you an idea of how the mafia works. But at one point I said to myself, all this time we spent putting into making money, if I just infuse a real moral code into it and I go out there and use everything that I've learned, first of all, the mafia is the biggest Machiavellian organization in the world. So no one could out-Machiavelli me. When people try to get slick or sly with me, and I just catch it like immediately. I have an intuitive sense for that. You're not getting over on me. It's not happening. So if I don't try to Machiavelli anyone, but I could defend myself against someone who might do it against me, I'm in good shape, and basically use all the things I've learned on the streets to make money and just do it with a moral code. And I knew that if I did that, I would be successful. And that's what I did. Basically mobsters are the most charismatic guys you ever met. Why do people get in bed with the mob? It's not this guy with a broken nose who shows up at your door with brass knuckles and asks you if you want to give him his company. Give your company to him. It's usually a guy who kind of gets close with you, and he's a charismatic guy, and you end up liking him. And then you're happy to give him a piece of your company. A lot of times what happens is then mobsters get greedy, and then people get hurt because the mobster wants more and more and more, and the guy can't pay it. But in the beginning, usually it's a friendly relationship. I had a million friends when I was in the mob, and they knew I was carrying a gun. I had a million legit friends who would do business with me any day of the week. So I figured if I just continue to build relationships just the way I did in the mob, but obviously, do things right and use the things I learned in the mob. Like, for example, a sit down. I talk about this in my book. Let's meet in the back for a sit down. How many people I know come to me and they own companies and there are people fighting over a commission, people who can't go walk by each other in the offices because they can't get along with each other for nothing. And I'll tell them, take them in the back and have a sit down. What do you mean? Have a sit down. Let them air it out. Put their beef on the table, and you should settle it. Make them shake. And in the mob, you couldn't walk. For all the violence you see that happens in the mob, a million times a day, and it's happening right now as we speak somewhere in New York, I promise you, a million times a day, beefs are settled at the table. And the decisions are always just. When you bring your beef to the table in the mob, guy could rob you for $1 million. They don't want you shooting the guy because it's bad for business. Then the law enforcement gets involved and, you know, there's investigations and people start going to jail. That's only a last resort. Somebody gets shot. You know, most of the time you go to the table, you lay your beef on the table. If you're in the right, whoever's presiding over the beef, the captain or capo in charge, he's going to rule for you. There's no politics involved or nothing. It's, I never lost the beef. I beat the boss, the acting boss of the Lucchese crime family. I beat him at a sit down. It was a hijacked truck. There was a couple of hundred grand on the line. I put my case on the table. I said, this is what happened. And he shook my hand and said, I apologize. You win. This is the boss of the family. He has my life in his hands. He could kill me at the table if he wants. And he said, I concede. You win. Because it's fair. So I feel like if people do that on a daily basis in the real world, how much could be settled without courts and lawyers and civil suits and, you know, somebody doesn't want to pay. I don't want to pay the check. I don't want to, because the merchandise was damaged. It only takes a cool head to prevail to say, okay, let's sit down. How much of the merchandise was damaged? Can I make up for that? Can I take off what was damaged? Can I fix it? Is there anything we could do about this? Instead, people will drag something like that out for years and nobody wins in the end. So that's just one example of something that I learned in the mob that I apply every day in the real world.
Incredible amounts of common sense and balls of steel. So let's talk about this, another concept in the book where you make a case that mobsters are selfish men, clearly, as you point out, but they're out for personal gain, and so are businessmen. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, how we think we're so pure and perfect and the mob is so bad and evil, but it's not the case. Talk about that.
Okay, so the business, obviously the mobsters are greedy, all right, but they advertise that. They don't try to say they're not. Businessmen are just as greedy, and it's human nature. Human nature is constant. I don't care if you're a politician, if you're a businessman, if you're a mobster. The bottom line is the buck. I mean, that's what you're out for every day. And I have really, really, you know, in the mob, people put the brakes on their greed because they know there are repercussions. You know, gee, if I'm really greedy and I beat Louis out of all his money, he just might be waiting outside my house behind a bush one day. And, you know, he could just easily just, you know, shoot me. You know, so why bother with this? You know, let him have the money. In the real world, business people don't care. You know, I bump into a lot of people. There are good businessmen who do live by moral code and they do pay their debts. Those are the ones that go the farthest. I know quite a few of them. But there are some real louses out there too. You know, if I don't have a contract with some people, I'm getting beat. And I know it. You know, recently, and it's, you know, I don't want to talk about it because it's just something that happened recently where I let somebody, I did somebody a favor and sent somebody to somebody else who made money with that person, and it was understood that there would be sort of a commission for me, and it wasn't in writing, and I just took a shot with it. I knew the person. They were pretty cool. Done. Never got a nickel out of it. And, you know, I figured, you know, it wasn't a major big deal, so I figured it was okay. You know, let's see. That person doesn't realize they're very short-sighted. They lose me. They lose me forever because I'll never make the same mistake twice. So I'm okay. I'm willing to lose that person. And I don't feel like it's a loss because I feel like I'm all the better for it, having, you know, discerned what their true nature or character is. And I won't do it again. I move on. And, you know, they've contacted me and I've just ignored the calls. I'm done with that person. So I do, you know, through that process of weeding out people who aren't greedy, who do see the long-term relationship as being more important, those are the people that I've been now able to, you know, weed through the rest and the riffraff and be able to now establish a really good network of people who I deal with and I know. You know, I know we could do business as the contracts are getting done. You know, as our lawyers are working out the contract, we could start to do business in good faith. And those are the people that I like to do business with. So, but I have encountered a number of business people who will beat you if they can. You know, it's a sad because they just see the short term. You know, they don't see it as, if they had any brains, they would say, you know, why burn this bridge? You know, it's someone who I might be able to do something with in the long term. But I do encounter these business people. And those business people that are like that, they have to constantly find new people to beat. And I feel like, you know, it's just like it becomes a vicious cycle, their lives. And there's no real gain from those. But the better business people that I do deal with are people who know, you know, that, hey, 10 years from now, you know, why not pay him the $100,000 I owe this guy? 10 years from now, I might make a million with him. You know, that's I think, you know, the long-term people are the people I like to deal with. But business people could be just as greedy. I mean, go try to look at the housing market that crashed. I mean, if that's not a perfect example of how greedy business people, you know, if a mobster, if a guy owed me money, and let's use $100,000 again. If a guy owed me $100,000 and he told me I don't have the money, Lou. You know, I just don't have it. I'm not throwing him out of his house. How many people got thrown out of the house and foreclosed on, gone? You know, the banks just said, too bad, you can't make a mortgage payment, you're gone. Take your two-year-old and your infant and get the hell out. They didn't care. How many banks and mortgage brokers gave these people mortgages knowing that it was an adjustable rate loan and it could go up and they could get screwed? I mean, I would never do that. As a mobster, I knew that the guy had, how much do you make a week? I make $800 a week. Okay, can you afford to pay me $100 a week? Yeah, I can. I wouldn't tell him it's an adjustable rate. You might owe me $600 a week one day. And knowing the guy can't afford to pay it, and then I'm going to take everything that's his. Yet the business world did that. And you know, what's sad about that is nobody really paid for it either. You know, we trust that our officials above us would call someone to task for that disaster, and no one really paid for it. So, you know, who knows what's next. But anyway. Oh, I paid for my crimes, by the way. I was having to pay for my crimes. I think you need to pay for crimes to realize they're wrong. That's why I say that.
It gets so complicated, and you're absolutely right, and I'm shocked that anyone would cross you. Just saying.
Yeah. Well, it happens. I mean, you know, first usually people make sure that I'm 100%, you know, not that guy anymore, and, you know, people are Machiavellian, like I said. You know, and I don't want to play the role and let people think that, oh, you know, I might still get, you know, might still get something in my head and come after you. You know, I don't want to do that. If I have to stoop that low to get paid, I'm not going to do it.
Well, I'm not actually suggesting that. I'm just saying that, you know. I just think, you know, bad choice. Anyway. So, but clearly your book has struck a chord. This message is so intense and incredible, and you know, you're bringing to life a world that most people only see, you know, on The Sopranos and on TV and in fictionalized versions, but this is the real deal. And you know, clearly Mob Rules was nominated for the prestigious Business Book Award 800 CEO Read. You were listed as a Forbes columnist by Mark Cramer's World's Best Business Books, and your business skills have been highlighted in publications including London's Financial Times, The Times of India, Business Week, and Crain's New York Business, just to name a few. So what does this type of success feel like to you?
It feels, thank God, it feels good. It feels like I know that life is what you put into it, you get out of it. And I felt like when I was in prison, I was paying for the things that I did. And it was what I put into life, I got out of it. I ended up in a prison cell, in a cage like an animal. That's pretty much what I deserved. But I knew from paying and suffering punishments, I knew that you would also, if you lived right and did right, you would get rewards. And I felt that. And I felt like the universe would owe me an explanation if that's not the way it panned out. So I put a lot of hard work into getting somewhere. I've read thousands of books. I'm still an avid reader. I still believe in isolation. I still, you know, believe in solitary time when I just, you know, can knock out 400 or 500-page books still. I still do that. Treat people right. Just as I treated people bad and I paid for it, treat people right, and that's got to come back to you too. I believe in karma, if you want to call it karma. The world is round. So it kind of like sometimes, you know, when all these things are happening, nice today, thank God, like my show was rated through the roof all over the globe, the show that I host, produced, and wrote for Discovery Networks International, rated through the roof. It's coming here to America now. You will see it in America. I put hard work into that. I feel like the harder we work as individuals with teams, teamwork, if you have a company, if you put 1,000% into it, sometimes you'll have hard times. Sometimes there's a roller coaster ride. Sometimes the economy might hurt your company. And you know, there are larger forces at work. But I feel like if you stick it out and you stick your nose to the grindstone, and you think outside the box, and you're willing to be, you know, to change maybe a little flexibility, maybe sell mufflers instead of wheels, whatever the case is, whatever you might be doing, I feel like you'll make it in the end. You know, God or the forces in the universe or whatever, the physics, whatever you believe in, whatever's out there at work, the world has a way of repaying good with good and bad with bad, and just live right. And I think it comes back. So, yeah, so I feel like when things happen that are nice, and you just read off some nice things to me that I've accomplished, I feel, once again, just hard work, live right, do right by others, and it comes back.
And you definitely give back a ton. Tell us a little bit about some of the groups that you go to and speak at.
Yeah, so I do a lot of talks. I do EO, YPO, and WPO. I've done them all over the country. I've done them also in Canada and South Africa. I do a lot of keynote addresses for different organizations. Everything from agricultural stuff to hardware, you name it. Different companies bring me in all the time. And I love doing it. And I keep in touch with the guys that I meet, guys and gals that I meet at these places, just to, you know, I really established some really good friendships at these business group meetings and stuff. And so I love doing talks. Yeah, it's just basically, it's usually based on my book, What the Mafia Can Teach You. And what you don't understand, I go through, in my book, I go through what a lot of people don't understand, I mean, is you say, what can the mafia teach the legitimate businessman? This is, I like, my anxiety was, is this going to be taken seriously? And I thank God that it was, because it really, there's a lot to learn. If you like the mafia, there's a million good mafia stories in there. So you're going to get your taste of the Sopranos and Casino when you read my book, which is great. So you'll get that. But you're also going to walk away with a lot of valuable things about, you know, mobsters know how to do business when it comes down to it. You know, they might wear a pinstripe suit, but if you take away the pinstripe suit and the violin case and you know, just take their business savvy and you say, let's just measure them by that, these guys know how to do business. And I feel like there's a lot to learn in the book. And when the mafia was running on time, on schedule, you know, up to code, they were a rocking organization. You know, I mean, if you got hurt by the mob, it was because you deserved it. You know, in their little world, if you fell into their world and you did something really bad, you had it coming. Now, unfortunately, people more and more, as I said earlier in this conversation, people get hurt and they don't have it coming, and that bothered me. You should never, you know, I was taught by the old timers, we don't kill for $1 billion. You know, it doesn't matter how much money. And you never should be greedy with somebody. So, you know, I learned the real good things by them. So it becomes a book of ethics, business ethics, believe it or not. And again, I understand the mafia has a twisted code. I'm not trying to say they don't. I don't believe in it anymore. I think it's despicable, but it was a code. So imagine how far your small to medium business can go, or large business, if a legit company has a code. If the mafia lasted from, you know, hundreds of years in Sicily, and 100 years in America, they've lasted that long with a code. How much further can your little company go with a code? And I believe in that. You know, if you have a small company and you teach family values and you believe in things, and, you know, if somebody doesn't have the money, it's a customer, you know, okay, no problem. When will you have it? You know, do things the old-fashioned way. I believe that pays off. I really do. Just my belief, and most of the people who've lived by my book now have seen the same thing. I get emails from business consultants all over the globe. My book is a runaway bestseller in Spain and Portugal. I get emails constantly from people there who say, I live by your book. I, you know, it's my Bible. I keep it on the table. Some people might keep Marcus Aurelius on their bed table. Some people might keep Plato on their bed table. I have people who email your book here. I have other people who email me. A guy emailed me in Connecticut and said, I bought 200 employees for my company your book, and I told them, read it, and I'm going to quiz you on it. So, I mean, these to me are things that flatter me, but at least I feel like I'm giving back from something that was bad. You know, I made lemonade out of lemons, you know, to be able to at least help people now with the garbage life that I once lived.
That's just amazing. So why do you think your message resonates with such a diverse group of people?
Probably, people, maybe they're attracted to the beginning of the mob thing. Everybody likes watching that entertaining stuff on TV, see what it's about. And, so my inside stories are great. A lot of them are personal stories that happened to me on the streets. And then I draw like a business conclusion from them. But I think because it's real, I think once people picked up the book and started to read it and saw that it was real, that it wasn't just like some comic thing that some mob guy put out, some guy who, I don't know, who's in the witness protection program maybe puts out a book and you say, what the heck is this? No, this is somebody who really turned their life around, didn't snitch, became a legitimate businessman and wants to, I guess, just pass on what I've learned. And it's resonated throughout the world, 15 languages it's in. And I think that's because once they read it, they see that it's real people and then they pass it on. I guess word of mouth drives the book, drives sales, et cetera. And it's been successful because of that. Also, too, since I'm such an avid reader, I was able to work in a lot of historical content. So sometimes to reinforce a point, I'll draw conclusions from the mob and then I'll reinforce the point with a historical episode. I'll pick out some type of character from history. It might be a Roman or a Greco-Roman character, or a king of England or a king of Germany or something, and I might express how that person was able to turn this same situation around in wherever it was, during the Middle Ages or whatever. So I do a lot of vignettes like that in the book where I add a lot of world history, and I think that was able to give a lot of world appeal to people where everybody's countries are mentioned, et cetera, and that's had a really good effect too. I figured I'd use all the books I read, that knowledge too, and pass that on. It's worked well.
Wonderful. And in fact, lots of big smart organizations have pulled you in to share your big smart ideas. In 2011, you spoke at the Economist's Ideas Economy 2011, the Human Potential Summit, and there you shared a stage with Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel laureate in economics at Princeton, and Nitin Noria, the dean of Harvard Business School, and other top global business leaders, including Steve Case, the founder of AOL and the chairman of Startup America. So, was that a moment in your life when you felt like you had truly arrived at this new place?
I actually felt, obviously from the list of people you just named, I felt very out of place. Yeah, I saw the list. I got the invitation to talk from the people at The Economist, and I looked at the list of people I was speaking with, and it's mind blowing. They're titans. I'm a little goldfish in that ocean of the sharks you just named. Those guys are amazing. There were some amazing women there as well. That spoke as well. I just was blown away that they even contacted me, which was awesome. And I guess because of the nature of my background, my talk went over really, really well. I didn't even have anything really super planned. I had a loose estimate of what I was going to talk about when I got on stage, and I just let it roll. And the way I talk to you right now, just whatever, I talk from the heart. And it went over really, really well. But I was blown away when they contacted me, and I had to tip my hat to the Economist because, I felt like they really did a courageous thing by calling up an ex-mobster and sticking them on that stage with all those titans, and that was awesome. I'm not sure where they came. I think someone mentioned maybe the London Financial Times or something. Maybe Crane's Business, Crane's New York did an article. Someone came across me somehow, then read the book and was blown away by the book and then contacted me. But once again, I just, I was just flattered to be on the stage with those people. It was just, they're all really, really super, super titans to me. And it was an honor to be on that stage with them.
Well, it sounds like you're becoming that too. So let's turn to PR roles before we let you go. Not PR roles, I'm sorry. Let's turn to mob roles. PR roles is my upcoming book. Thank you. I'll send it to you. You can talk about it. So in part one, you talk about lessons for a soldier. Can you pick out your top lesson that you think our listeners and readers should know about?
Sure. Turning garbage into gold. And that's basically, mobsters do that every day. I knew a guy, Sal Avellino was his name, and he, you know, he was a really, he was an old timer, lived by the code. Years ago, when I was a kid, it was on the David Letterman show every night. There was this big barge of garbage that no one would accept. He tried to, this garbage barge was driving all over the ocean, and no country would accept the garbage, allow them to dump it. What happened was he was a capo for the Lucchese family. And the FBI tipped off everybody and said, don't accept this garbage anymore. This guy was dominating the garbage industry in Long Island for years. Now, he did a lot of bad things, granted, you know, to expand his company. So he wasn't completely legit, but he did have a great business savvy. And he wasn't a guy who wasn't, he wasn't afraid to get dirty. And every day, the mob turns garbage into gold. I use that as my initial example. I mean, he was collecting garbage. You know, he's here. A lot of people say, oh, garbage. I don't want to be involved with garbage. There's trillions of dollars in the garbage industry. And mobsters jumped into that industry years ago and locked it down because of that. You know, now they've been pushed out and stuff, and there are big management, waste management companies that have taken over. So people now are hip to it, and they've moved in, and they've pushed the mob out. But they got hip to it 30 years after the mob did. And the mob just does that every single day. They look for something that, you know, how can I make a buck out of something? How can I turn something into something? Every day they go out there and do that. And that's the lesson you learn from when you're just starting out in the mob. How can I make money? Because nobody in the mafia, what nobody understands is, even if you're John Gotti, who was the boss of the family, nobody handed him anything. He had to start out on the bottom floor and work his way up to the top. Nobody gives you anything. It's what you can make is what you have. So you always have to create new ways of making money. And the mob's famous for that. And I just lend that lesson to business all over. If something slows down, look for something else you could do in this business. How else can you expand? Think outside the box. You know, if you sell pillows, start selling mattresses, whatever the case is, you know, and just turn your garbage into gold.
I love that. Okay, part two, lessons for the capo, which is middle management. What's your favorite one?
Okay, so my favorite is the one I talked about, because I think peace equals prosperity. And, I, you know, let's meet in the back for a sit down. That to me is just so important. I think it's so necessary to always, always have peace. Just, you know, to basically just get people getting along. You know, it's a team effort if you have a company. Being that I talked about that one, I'll throw one more out there. This is an off-kilter one. I wrote Toss the Dice High, Dealing with Ultimatums. And here's where I worked in a mobster and a historical figure. Julius Caesar, when he was ordered to return to Rome and face the Senate, he was out there warring with, I think, Germanic tribes. And he had to come back. And he said, you know, he knew if he came back, they were going to kill him. They were going to do away with him, the Senate. And if he didn't come back, they were going to label him a traitor. And he basically tossed the dice high. And that's what Plutarch, the ancient writer, tells us he said when he got to the Rubicon. He said, the die is cast, is one phrase they say he used. But Plutarch says, he says, toss the dice high. In other words, let's see where they land. I'm gambling with my fate. And he went back to Rome and took over the Senate, took over the empire. And he really, really, that dealt with an ultimatum. And I then drew a lesson with John Gotti, who did the same thing when he took over the family. Few people know. Everybody thinks he was like this driven Napoleonic figure who just craved power, where that wasn't the case. Basically, the boss of the family at the time, Paul Castellano, gave John an ultimatum. He said John's brother and best friend were on trial for a drug case. And dealing drugs was against the code in the Gambino crime family, punishable by immediate death. And Castellano said that, you know, your brother and your best friend, if they were in fact dealing drugs, and the tapes that the government has says so, they're going to die. Give me the tapes. So John was faced with an unreasonable ultimatum, and he basically said, if I hand the tapes over, I'm committing the murders of my brother and my best friend. If I don't hand the tapes over, I'm committing my own murder, because Castellano will kill me for my disobedience. And he tossed the dice high, and in one night he struck and killed the boss and the underboss of the Gambino crime family and took it over. That's how he dealt with the unreasonable ultimatum. How I bring it around to business, this example of Caesar and Gotti and Castellano, is if you're in a job situation or a business situation where you're given an unreasonable ultimatum, don't be afraid to toss the dice high, and not by violent means, but If you lose your job, maybe it means a better one awaits. If you lose your client, maybe that customer wasn't, would have double-crossed you at one point or another or whatever. Don't be afraid if you're pushed up against the wall to move on. And you know, a lot of people are afraid of moving on. How do I lose my job? I'd rather suck it up. But I'm the type of person to deal with an unreasonable ultimatum by trusting in fate and destiny. If you live correctly and you do right by others, I feel like then the world will eventually pay you back, as I said earlier. And I feel like just toss the dice high and see where they land. And that's what I believe in. So that's one of the lessons I draw in the book.
Yeah, sounds like that's definitely a lesson you live by as well, which is impressive. I try and live by that lesson too.
here's another one for the Don, if you own a company.
Yeah, that's the next one. The Don, the boss.
So, yeah, don't build Yankee Stadium. Just supply the concrete. And that's basically spotting new rackets. If mobsters, they run New York, so when the new Yankee Stadium was being built, I know for a fact they could not get the contract to build Yankee Stadium. You know, the Steinbrenners in the city weren't going to turn around and say to the Gambino or the Lucchese family, hey, why don't you guys build Yankee Stadium? How much do you want to, you know, what's your bid? They knew they couldn't get the contract. But what a mobster does is he looks at the stadium and he says, okay, fine, how can I make a buck off this? The stadium is going to need plastic seats. The stadium is going to need sod. The stadium is going to need signposts. The stadium is going to need hot dogs. The stadium is going to need bases. The stadium, the team is going to need uniforms. And that's how a mobster looks at everything. It's almost like a 3D image of how can I make money off this? And I think every businessman has to do that, every small company to medium company, large company should as well. But I think most of your audience is small and medium, if I'm not mistaken. Look at every which way you could look at something and figure out where is the niche, what part of this world hasn't been completely flooded by people who are going to bid against me. There must be something here that I could lock down, that I could monopolize for a short time before everyone's doing it. And that's what a mobster does every day. And I feel like, you know, businesses, especially in this economic atmosphere, you constantly need to be thinking out of the box. How else can I make money?
Yep. We talk about it, call it the icing and cake metaphor, that most small business owners don't realize that the reason that they started their business should be the icing on their cake. That should pay all their bills. But the real value proposition is the cake. What's your core competency? Leverage it from every angle that you possibly can. So
I love it.
I love yours too.
I love that example. I love cake too, so it really hung it home.
Well, I was raised by a bookie, so I think we're in the same. I love Gino.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
It's a different perspective on it. He taught me a lot of stuff. We'll talk about that after the call. All right, talk about the epilogue. Be a pizza egg roll. What do you mean by that?
Okay, so I had spoken about Machiavelli early in the conversation, and I, you know, mobsters all, you know, they pride themselves on being Machiavellian. They've never read The Prince. They've never read Discourses. They don't know, you know, exactly what Machiavelli wrote. But they have a sense that it means kind of like outfoxing somebody, which it does mean. Pizza egg roll means Machiavelli is the pizza. And you could be, you should be able to sense a Machiavellian character. You could be smart enough to be able to deal with those characters, so that's the pizza. But be an egg roll. I picked Confucius as a guy who said that by virtue alone, you should transcend everyone else. So if your company rests itself on virtue, that's, you know, if you make core values in your company and you say, hey, listen, this is who we are, this is who we're always going to be, we're never going to bend to pressure or to our lower traits and primitive instincts of just making money any way we can and, you know, bulldozing over people, etc. In the long run, if you abide by the philosophy of a Confucius who believed in virtue, who believed in doing things right, I feel like you'll prevail. So be a pizza egg roll. Know how to deal with the Machiavellis. Be up to them, you know, on their level if they're dealing with you and you have to combat them. You know what a Machiavelli is. Study him if you need be. The Prince is a very short book. I recommend it to anybody. I like to know those type of things. I read about a Hitler and a Stalin, maybe to know how not to be, you know, but I'll read about the bad guys and the good guys and know how to deal with a Hitler or a Stalin if I encounter one. But be a pizza egg roll, be a Machiavelli who was Italian, and be an egg roll, a Confucius rather, who was an egg roll, let's say, in my analogy. Be a pizza egg roll. And that's, I think that's the secret to success.
Well, you clearly have taken, made lemonade out of some amazing lemons, and we appreciate your wisdom, Louis Ferrante, author of Mob Rules, What the Mafia Can Teach the Legitimate Businessman. And we do very much hope to stay in touch with you and follow your success and the wisdom that you continue to share with the legitimate business community.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to keeping in touch with you, and I wish all the best to you and your audience. Hope.
Thank you. Definitely run out and buy a copy of Mob Rules. You will not regret it, and you will appreciate the wisdom of Louis Ferrante. You are listening to the Incandescent Radio Network. This is Hope Gibbs, your host. We'll look forward to talking to you soon. Have a great day.
So that's it for today's Incandescent Entrepreneur Show, where we always ask, what's your story? If you have a good one and would like to be interviewed on the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show, send me an email to hope@hopegibbs.com. Check back every Monday at noon for a new episode of the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, www.incandescentradio.com. We look forward to talking to you next week. Here's to your incredible, indelible success.